Thanks, Jeff and Barb. It's good to have them back. They were traveling the world for quite some time. They've been back for a little while now, but I'm grateful to have them back. Welcome to First Free. If I haven't met you, my name is Matt. I serve as pastor here. Glad to have you here with us. If you're streaming, hello. It's good to be with you. I just want a life that actually works. What do I mean by that? Like a life with meaningful work, with time to exercise, with time to be creative, whether that's on my guitar or in the kitchen. A life where I have the ability to be present with my wife, with my kids, with my friends, with my neighbors. I want a life where I have time to be present with myself, to the inner workings of my own soul. I know that I can only be present to God if I can be present to others and to myself, and I know I want that. I know that I want a life of connection to God, to others, to myself, a life where when people ask, "How are you doing?" my answer doesn't include that four-letter word, busy. A life where I'm not rushing from one thing to another. A life where I can say no to good things and good people without that feeling of guilt that can linger in the background. A life where I'm content with what I have rather than preoccupied with what I think I want or need. I just want a life that actually works. What about you? Would you like a life like that? Now, maybe you already have a life like that. And if that's the case, please, please pull me aside after service and let me know how you've achieved it. I will pay. Most of us, though, I'm guessing, are plagued with feeling like we're doing too much. Right? How are you doing? Good. Just busy. We're doing too much. Or maybe with feeling like we're not doing enough. We feel like we're missing out on what really matters. And I guess that there's many of us who somehow feel both at the same time. Somehow we feel like we're doing too much. Our lives are too busy, too stressed, too rushed, too full. And yet somehow at the same time, we're not doing enough. I could be more well-read. I could be a better friend, a more intentional parent, a more adventurous traveler, maybe a more committed Christian, a more cultured appreciator of the arts, a less cultured appreciator of sports, whatever it is. No laughter at that one? Okay. Whatever it is, this sort of double bind that we're in of somehow doing too much and yet feeling like we're not doing enough, not only is it exhausting, but it robs us of the ability to truly enjoy the life we have and to encounter the presence of God within it, within our actual, ordinary, everyday life. And because our lives are both busy and unsatisfied, we're left rushing from one thing to another. There's too much already to do, and yet we feel like we're not doing enough. So we're always rushing to the next thing, plagued by the spiritual sickness of hurry. The spiritual sickness of hurry. Do you ever feel like you're hurried? Like there's too much hurry in your life? To me, when I feel that feeling, that overwhelming feeling of busyness, of hurry, it feels like the walls are kind of closing in on me. It feels like I have no space or margin or time to even let out a proper exhale. Even now in the middle of this sermon, I'm like, should I give that enough time or should I keep talking? Because I don't want the sermon to be too long, but my exhale is pretty long because my lungs are pretty big. I'm running from thing to thing, usually showing up late to each one, and totally missing out on anything that God might have for me in the midst of all those things. Because stuff simply has to get done. Life, when I'm hurried, feels congested, it feels constricted, it feels cramped, it feels like everything is getting tighter and tighter and tighter. I need salvation. You might be wondering, salvation? This is odd that our pastor is saying he does not have salvation. What does that, salvation, have to do with this? With hurry? With feeling like things are closing in on you? Isn't salvation about being rescued from hell and damnation? Eugene Peterson says that the root meaning in Hebrew of salvation is to be broad, to become spacious, to enlarge. It carries the sense of deliverance from an existence that has become compressed, confined, and cramped. Friends, do you want to get saved? Peterson isn't making this up. He's not just trying to create a clever turn of phrase. This is all over the place in the Old Testament. You see it quite often in the Psalms, but also at other places. My favorite time that this phrase, a spacious place, is used is in Psalm 18. I'll read to you verses 16 through 19. This says about God, "He reached down from on high and took hold of me. He drew me out of deep waters. He rescued me from my powerful enemy, from my foes who were too strong for me. They confronted me in the day of my disaster, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a spacious place. He rescued me because he delighted in me." Do you want this kind of salvation? Not just salvation for your soul when you die, but salvation for your soul as you live. Salvation from the solitary confinement of hurry and busyness that modern life seems to offer us as a buffet. Do you want deliverance from an existence that has become compressed, confined, and cramped? The famous psychologist Carl Jung had this little saying. He said, "Hurry is not of the devil. Hurry is the devil." Or maybe to take it from psychology back to theology, what about C.S. Lewis? You've heard of C.S. Lewis, yes. Mere Christianity, the Narnia guy, you know, with the wardrobe and stuff. Regarded as one of the most prolific Christian writers of the 20th century. Well, there was a man behind C.S. Lewis, his spiritual director, Walter Adams. And a spiritual director is someone you meet with regularly who helps you notice and nurture the work of God in your life. And C.S. Lewis had one, this man Walter Adams. And Adams said this to him, "To walk with Jesus is to walk with a slow, unhurried pace. Hurry is the death of prayer and only impedes and spoils our work. It never advances it." That goes against almost everything many of us are ingrained to think. If I hurry, I can get more done, not less done. Hurry, according to Walter Adams, will make it nearly impossible to walk with Jesus. Why? Because Jesus isn't in a hurry. And so you're walking at two different paces. I lived in New York City for 5 years. And one thing that happens when you live there, probably even just more than 6 months, is your pace of walking starts to increase. Because, one, you're walking a lot. You get off the train and you have to walk somewhere, and you're probably also in a hurry. So you start walking really quite fast, and you don't even notice it. It just becomes your pace. You notice it when you see, like, a tourist walking next to an actual New Yorker, because it's a very different cadence, a very different pace. And one time my mom came and visited, and, you know, we were just doing regular things, and I was just walking, and then I turned around, and my mom wasn't there anymore. Because she was walking like a tourist. Also an old lady tourist. So she was walking quite slow. I was walking like a New Yorker, really fast. And we were no longer walking together. The metaphor of walking with Jesus isn't just a cutesy Christian way of speaking. You can walk with him or not, but you will probably have to slow down. Or you'll turn around and wonder, where is he? John Mark Comer wrote a book a few years back called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. And in it he says this. This is a longer quote, so stay with me. He says, hurry and love are incompatible. All my worst moments as a father, a husband, and a pastor, even as a human being, are when I'm in a hurry. Late for an appointment, behind on my unrealistic to-do list, trying to cram too much into my day, I ooze anger, tension, a critical nagging, the antithesis of love. If you don't believe me, next time you're trying to get your type B wife and three young, easily distracted children out of the house and you're running late, a subject on which I have a wealth of experience, just pay attention to how you relate to them. Does it look and feel like love? Or is it far more in the vein of agitation, anger, a biting comment, a rough glare? Hurry and love are oil and water. They simply do not mix. Then he goes on to say, hurry kills relationships. Love takes time. Hurry doesn't have it. Hurry kills joy, gratitude, appreciation. People in a rush don't have time to enter the goodness of the moment. It kills wisdom, because wisdom is born in the quiet, the slow. Wisdom has its own pace. It makes you wait for it. Wait for the inner voice to come to the surface of your tempestuous mind, but not until waters of thought settle and calm. Hurry kills all that we hold dear. Spirituality, health, marriage, family, thoughtful work, creativity, generosity. Name your value. Hurry is a sociopathic predator loose in our society. He doesn't mince words. Are you feeling this? Are you resonating with this? Or is this just me? Am I the only one who feels like I'm in a rush sometimes? I want to ask some questions. I'll take a moment to ask these slowly. These are adapted from the writings of a woman named Ruth Haley Barton, who happens to be a mentor of mine. And this is a sort of inventory for your soul. You can see if you relate to this series. There's maybe 10 or so. I haven't counted them. But let's just see. When I put it on the screen, I'll read it aloud, and you just see, does this resonate? Some will be yes, some will be no. And pay attention. Maybe count on your fingers how many of these are adding up. If you have a notebook and journal, you want to write it down, go ahead. Let's begin. Ask yourself if this is true of you. I find myself rushing from one thing to the next without time to really pay attention to what's going on in and around me. Next, I am keeping up with what my work requires, but deep down, I feel that I have lost touch with who I am in God and what He has called me to do. I am tired, not just physically and emotionally, but spiritually and emotionally. I don't really know how to get rested. I am aware of an underlying irritability and restlessness just beneath the surface of my life. I can't stop working, even when I know I need to. I have become emotionally numb, unable to experience a full range of human emotion. I find myself increasingly giving in to escapist behaviors, binge eating, mindless television viewing, substance abuse, shopping, spending, pornography, etc., or escapist fantasies, dreaming about being somewhere else or having a different life. I do not have time for attending to my human needs, exercise, eating right, getting enough sleep, going to doctor's appointments, medical procedures, picking up dry cleaning, getting the car washed, making home repairs, right? All those human things. My most significant human relationships are getting shortchanged. I don't have time to regularly engage in hobbies and other activities that bring me joy. Last one. I find myself hoarding energy, avoiding people in the grocery store, holding up at home or in my office for fear that routine social interactions will rob me of my last bit of energy. Not in a spirit of judgmentalism, but in a spirit of observation and curiosity, how did that go for you? Did any of them ring true? Did all of them ring true? None of them, they're all meaningless to me. None of them land at all, you know, way beyond them. But if any of these ring true for you, perhaps we need to hear afresh these words that were read today from Jesus. Are you tired? Worn out? Burned out on religion? Come to me. Get away with me and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. I need to just pray for a minute. Lord, is this actually possible? Because some of us here have heard these words lots of times. We've seen them even crocheted or stitched into pieces of art hanging in someone's bathroom. They're very familiar to us. We heard these words and we started following you, and quite frankly, it feels like a bait and switch. The church has only made our lives busier Religion has only contributed to our burnout. God, we want to recover our lives. Show us how. Show us how to take a real rest. God, we want to live freely and lightly. God, what if someone asked, how are you? And we said, I'm pretty good. I'm feeling free and light. May it be so. Amen. Dallas Willard and John Mark Comer have spoken about something called the secret of the easy yoke. And while that sounds like a chef technique, it's not. In other translation of this passage from Matthew 11, Jesus says, take my yoke upon you. Familiar with that one? A yoke in his agrarian culture was a device that went on the shoulders of oxen, usually. It kept them together so that they could share the load, share the burden. It allowed them to be more effective even in their work. But in order for it to be effective, they had to do things in the same pace and rhythm. Imagine if one is moving ahead too quickly, you'd just be going in circles, right? Yoke was also an idiomatic saying of Jewish rabbis in Jesus' time. A rabbi's yoke was their interpretation of the Torah and the way in which you lived a life that was pleasing to God. By wearing the yoke, the figurative yoke, you walked alongside that rabbi and you practiced their way of life, which was meant to be an embodiment of their understanding of the teachings about God and also how to be human. So Jesus invites us into his yoke, into his way of life. So, what does Dallas Willard say is the secret of the easy yoke? Because we've heard this many, many times, and perhaps it isn't quite landing. It's not quite working as described. The promise is going unfulfilled. So, what's the deal? What's the secret? He says, if you want to experience the life of Jesus, you have to take on the lifestyle of Jesus. If you want to live freely and lightly, or think of the way Jesus lives, forgiving his enemies, even to the point of death on a cross, healing others, loving without condition. If you want to live like that, the life that Jesus had, it doesn't just happen. If you want the life of Jesus, you have to take on the lifestyle of Jesus. Imagine runners. Perhaps you've been walking down the lakefront trail or in a park or around your neighborhood and you see these runners just going by, right? Fit, thin, just kind of cruising at somehow this 6 minute 6 mile a minute pace, not even sweating. They're just doing it. And they got that smile, they got that runner's high. And you think, oh, I wouldn't mind that life. They seem to be healthy, they seem to be enjoying themselves, they can travel from point A to point B quite quickly. Yeah, I'd like that life. But then you think about the serious runner's lifestyle. Going to bed at 9 p.m., waking up at 5 a.m., a strict diet, an insane stretching routine that you have to do every single time, any number of other things. I'm not a serious runner, so I'm not quite sure everything that it entails. but that's because I've said, yeah, I'd like that life, but I'm not so sure about the lifestyle, so maybe it's not for me. Or imagine some guitarist who seems to just play effortlessly, always in the flow, always in the groove, always in the pocket. And you're like, oh, that feels cool. They're like jamming with the band. You know, I think I could get into that life, playing at the jazz club, whatever it is. And then you remember the lifestyle, practicing scales, developing calluses all over your fingers, saving up, investing money in a new amp, a new guitar, a new pedal, always a new pedal. Missing out on evenings with friends and family because there's another band rehearsal. Emailing promoters and venues so you can play shows. You get it. You get the picture, right? That's the lifestyle. You want the life without the lifestyle. We often want that, but we realize, I guess I can't have the life then. We seem to realize that in almost every area except for spirituality. For some reason, when it comes to spirituality, we think it should just happen. If we try hard enough to be like Jesus, if we try directly to do the things, we should be able to. What's wrong with me? Why can't I forgive everyone anymore? I've been trying for 25 years. What's wrong with me? We try harder and try harder and try harder and listen to people up here say, try harder and try harder. Until finally we think that the life of Jesus, it just isn't for us. So I'll just perhaps be a spectator. I'll keep coming to church. Or I'll read about Jesus, but I'm certainly not going to try and live like him. Or any number of things. And for good reason. We've tried really hard and it's exhausting. My invitation for us is to be able to step into a spacious place this summer where together we can explore not just the life, but the lifestyle of Jesus. See how he lived and see if we might step into some of those practices and rhythms together. Particularly practices of subtraction, of doing less. Doing less with more intention. The first practice in the lifestyle of Jesus that we'll touch on just barely today, because this was a long introduction to a 2-month-long series, so we don't got to cover it all today. But I want to touch just a little bit on simplicity. Simplicity. In a lot of ways, Jesus lived a life of simplicity. I'm struck by this story in Matthew 8. In the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 8, Jesus starts to develop a really large following. And if you've ever been liked by a lot of people, the feeling is often, let's keep it going. I'd like more people to like me. More and more and more. It feels good. Builds up my ego, gives me a sense of purpose in life. Jesus starts to get this big following. And there are so many opportunities for that following to multiply. More and more and more and more. I mean, he could do miracles, so it's not that hard of a thing to get it to multiply and multiply. But then this happens. In verse 18, Matthew 8, verse 18 says, when Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. So there's getting to be too many people. And he's like, how am I going to thin this out? Because it's a bit much. It's a little too time consuming. I wonder if he felt those feelings of, being confined, constricted, cramped in. So he literally says, let's go across the lake to something with a bit more space, wondering how he can say no to the threat of extreme popularity, which would bring about busyness. So he goes to the other side. And then in the next verse, a teacher of the law, right, a religious bigwig comes up to him and says, basically, go ahead, I'm going to follow you. Like, teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. In other words, go ahead and cross that lake. I'm coming. Maybe the masses won't. I'm going to go. I'm going to be a true follower. I want that life you got, that life of Jesus. And Jesus replies, foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Jesus is like, you want the life? This is the lifestyle. Like, I don't have a house right now. I want you to get that, teacher of the law. There's not a comfy bed that every night I retire to. So do you really want to live like this? Do you want my lifestyle? Because it's one of radical simplicity. Do you want that, teacher? Jesus reveals simplicity as a way of life. And as you observe in the Gospels, I encourage you to read them regularly and often. You'll notice that Jesus doesn't overload his schedule with doing, but he prioritizes these profound pockets of being with his Father, even to the point of frustrating his closest followers, his disciples. A life of simplicity is a life of letting down many people, is the reality of it. Because you cannot say yes to everyone. Not even the Son of Man, the Son of God, could say yes to everyone's immediate needs. Jesus, though, because of this, ends up having time for inconveniences. Time for the unexpected passerby. He never seems in a hurry or distraught over the uncertainty of his Father's provision for him. And I believe this is because Jesus' simplicity flowed from this sort of single source of his unadulterated intimacy with his Father. This is why Jesus, when he's speaking about worry to some of his followers, he says, seek first the kingdom of heaven, and all these things will be added to you. Jesus had a singular focus, anchored in a rich attachment to his heavenly Father. And that became for him a source of deep contentment, profound wholeness, and even glorious freedom from the incessant longing for more. This sort of thing is rare, which is why people were drawn to Jesus, why we still today are drawn to the teachings and way of Jesus. It's hard to develop anything close to this level of contentment found only in the source of God. But it is possible. Paul apparently caught hold of this same vision of contentment in God. He says famously in Philippians 4, verse 11, he's talking to people who are supporting him financially in his ministry. And he's basically saying, I'm not asking for more because I'm in need. He says, I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty, and I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. And then he tells us the secret. I can do all this through him who gives me strength. in one of the most misquoted verses of all time, Paul is saying, I can have contentment because I am connected to a source that never runs dry. And so when Paul writes these words to his mentee, his successor, young Timothy, he gives him these words that we read today. A devout life does bring wealth, but it's the rich simplicity of being yourself before God. Since we entered the world penniless, and we'll leave it penniless, if we have bread on the table and shoes on our feet, that's enough. He says that a life connected to God, a devout life, offers us the rich simplicity of being yourself before God. I love that. The rich simplicity of being yourself before God. It's great wordplay, rich simplicity. It's almost perhaps oxymoronic, or at least a bit of a paradox. A lot of a little, rich simplicity. The context to what Paul is saying to Timothy, in just the verse prior, there's apparently this group of people who thinks that godliness, connection to God, pursuing the way of God, is a means to financial gain. They think if we become connected to God, we will be rich in financial resources. If we follow the teachings of God and have holy lives, there'll be a financial payout. And I'll be honest, it's not that hard to think this way, at least not in the West. If I do the right things, I'll get rewards. But it reveals a lack of connection and communion with the living God. Because in moments of connection and communion with the living God, there's an overwhelming sense that I already have enough. I have everything I need in this God. I believe that Jesus modeled this deep communion with the Father, and Paul caught a taste of it. And that's why he then goes on to share it with Timothy. The wisdom of Paul to Timothy is that to experience this rich simplicity of being yourself before God, you must become content with what you have. You must realize that you have enough. Enough. Which produces an ability to say no. To say no to more. And until we can do that, until we can start saying no to more, we will never experience our time as truly spacious. Until we can say no, it will always feel like there's not enough. We'll constantly be filling it up with something or another. Always thinking we need more. And I include myself in this. More accomplishments. More things, more money, more square feet, more bullet points on the resume, more letters after our name, more. Every time that you feel that need for more of whatever it is, and sometimes it's hard to identify that you're even feeling it, but whenever you can, you can push back with just one word. Enough. Enough. So I want to leave you with two practices this week to begin, just begin, to approach the simplistic lifestyle of Jesus. Internal and external, you could say. Internally, I want you to get familiar with that word enough. And you can use these words if you want. They're helpful to me. In God, I already have enough. I have enough. I am enough. There is enough. I can say no. These need to like seep down deep. This is the connection that Jesus had to the source that allowed him then to live an externally simplistic life. See, without the internal connection to the source, without the real belief that I am enough, I have enough in God, any external simplicity or pursuing a life of minimalism, all that, will likely be some form of legalism, some form of trying to prove something to someone. It may not be God. It may be your neighbor or your friend. If they could just see how little I can live off of, I'll earn something from them. It's subtle, but it's there. But if this internal connection to the source that is God exists, then external simplicity will be a thing of beauty. Yeah. In God, I already have enough. I have enough. I am enough. There is enough. I can say no. One of the things these words do is they allow you to say no to good things. Not just bad things, not things you know you shouldn't do, but to the thing you think you ought to do. And they allow you then to begin to learn about discernment, which is noticing, is this something that God is nurturing in me? Is this something that God is inviting me into? And when you can say those words, then it creates a bit of a buffer. So before you say yes to the promotion that will provide you with so much more and probably trick you into thinking somehow you'll have more time because you have more money and so you can, what, buy more babysitters? I don't know. But it gives you enough time to pause and say, okay, is this something from God that will bring about true abundance in my life or not? Before you say yes to the new car because you saw the advertisement and it's a great deal, I can't say no. 0% financing, I'd be stupid not, I'd be losing money if I didn't buy it. You can pause a second and say, well, I already have enough. So would this new car actually contribute to mine and my neighbor's flourishing? Maybe you can get to where you need to go safer and quicker and it'll serve everyone involved. But maybe not. Maybe it's just going to try and meet some need that you know it's not actually going to meet when you're honest. So these words, they got some power if you let them really get ingrained. In God, I already have enough. I have enough. I am enough. There is enough. I can say no. It's freeing. Let this become a mantra for you. Secondly, there's an external practice, a bit of an experiment of letting go, okay? If you're going to take a photo of a slide, this would be a good one. So this week, here's the external practice you can have. Begin to list the possessions that you feel the most anxious attachment to. Okay, not just everything in your house, but what is that you like really, really, really love? If you're not sure, think through some of the things you have and ask yourself, what if I got rid of blank? You know the thing. And if you feel a strong reluctance to the idea of whatever that blank is, that's probably the thing that you should think about. I'm not saying give away everything you love, but this is just a way to learn to pay attention to some things, okay? Now, it might be any number of these things. Clothes, shoes, accessories, home furnishing, books, records, CDs, DVDs and Blu-rays. I must have copied and pasted that from 10 years ago. One of your streaming services. Video games, jewelry, appliances, kitchenware, kids' toys, right? Now relax. I promise I'm not going to guilt you into giving away whatever thing you identify. Okay? But as we together begin this practice, the invitation is to reach into your particular area of attachment and consider parting with something. You might sell it, donate it, or give it away. If a wardrobe is your thing, how would you feel if you parted with just a few outfits you like? What if you gave up some records? Some books on your shelf, a few pairs of shoes. Start small. Start small. If it's your car, if you love your car, what if you let someone borrow it one day a week? Right? I'm not going to tell you sell your car, give the money to the church, do it tomorrow. But how do you kind of loosen that hold of attachment so that you can honestly then say, I have enough. I am enough. Even this thing that I thought I could never let go of. It no longer controls me. Start small. Take note of how the process makes you feel. Be honest about it. Write it down. I feel super anxious. I feel like I'm being manipulated. Whatever it is. And follow that feeling and see where it goes. Then I encourage you to take these next three questions. Again, you can take a picture if you want, or you can ask me for them. I'll send them to you. And the idea with this is talk through these with people in your life. So don't just let this sit in your own soul, but talk to someone else about this. Here's the questions. How could parting with something you want to keep affect you differently than getting rid of something you don't really care about? Because it's one thing to clean out the closet and get rid of all the clothes you don't fit in anymore. I have many of those. It's another thing to give away something you love, right? Second question, can you already list the kinds of possessions with which you feel a certain attachment? Can you come to terms with them and name them? Well, I love this thing maybe a bit too much. And lastly, when you consider the idea of parting with something you think you want to keep, how do you feel and why? Okay. I encourage you, really, sit on these questions, practice this. Because if we want the life of Jesus, that free and light way of living, we have to practice the lifestyle of Jesus. Friends, will you pray with me? Father, we thank you. That even now, if we're feeling anxious, we can say, in God, in Christ, we have and are enough. We do not need to earn a thing from you. We do not need to prove any of this to you in order to receive love from you. It is given freely in abundance to all who would seek to receive it. So God, let us take a deep breath if we're feeling like we need to earn something. And yet, God, we actually want to experience the life of Jesus. So would you give us grace and courage and energy to take on the lifestyle of Jesus as we are able today. In the name of God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.